next matter is Adams Bank and Trust versus Brown. The next matter at this time will be Adams Bank and Trust versus Brown. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Steve Wendrum on behalf of Charles and June Brown, the appellants in this action. First, a bit of a housekeeping matter to clear up first. As I'm preparing for this brief, I take note that in my scope of review section of the brief, I made some misstatements insofar as the case being one at equity or one at law, and I realize that I must concede to that. The scope of review, as is in the brief of my opponent, that is, this is a case at law from the aspect of the consideration of this appeal as it relates to the trial itself and the evidence as a result of it.
As I say, your problem comes in the allegations in your counterclaims. You feel that that's raising equitable defenses?
Not now, Your Honor. I think this is a case of law it's completely. Okay. As I say, Charles and June Brown are the appellants in this action, and they made a mistake, too. They made a mistake in signing a deed of trust in favor of Adams Bank and Trust Company in April of 2006. They didn't know they'd made a mistake at the time, but they certainly found out later on, and of all the mistakes made, that was the least egregious. They did so on the basis of providing necessary security for an indebtedness of their son and daughter-in-law, Travis and Tina Brown, who were applying for a loan with that bank. And Travis and Tina Brown put up a 32-acre tract of their own as additional security for this particular loan. And Travis and Tina Brown then, a few years later, filed for a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and that was a mistake. They didn't know it at the time. As I describe it that way, I don't assign any culpability to them in that regard. But that action, and incidentally, that ultimately ended up being converted to a Chapter 7, but that action plunged the entire matter into what I'll just call a diffusion of responsibility among the interested parties in this tract of real estate as to who was going to pay the real estate taxes that would be due on this real estate on a continuing basis throughout the proceeding. And as a result of apparently nobody coming forward and paying those real estate taxes, they didn't get paid. Real estate taxes on that 32-acre tract were subject to tax sale certificates, which were bought up by an entity that does that. Ultimately, a treasurer's tax deed was applied for. Appropriate notices went out under the statute to everybody in respect to their right to redeem and the deadlines for them to do that. Nobody redeemed anything. This entire time, Charles and June Brown didn't know anything about this. That
raises a question that I have. I know that your allegations are that the bank had a fiduciary duty to either pay the taxes or to notify Charles and June, I believe it is?
Yes.
That the taxes had not been paid and give them the opportunity to pay the taxes. My question to you is, how can they take that position when their own son and daughter-in-law, who had not paid the taxes, didn't give them notice?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last question.
How can you say that when their own son and daughter-in-law knew that the taxes had not been paid and did not tell Charles and June?
Charles and June and their son and daughter-in-law are two, I'm going to use the word, separate entities for purposes of any imputation of liability, knowledge, notice, or otherwise in respect to the issues in this lawsuit.
Except that Tina and Tim asked... Travis and Tina asked Jane and Charles to sign this trust deed, taking their personal property, their real estate, and putting it in jeopardy for them. And yet, the contention is that Tina and Travis did not pay the taxes and did not notify their parents that they had done it.
I realize that's a contention of the bank. As I say, I don't think that the lack
well,
of
say,
doing that.
You say that they didn't know.
They did not know. They
so
said
then they couldn't have been told.
What say again?
If they didn't know, then Travis and Tina couldn't have told. And I'm saying to you that doesn't that seem strange to you?
Oh yeah, it is strange. It's strange, but strangeness to me in this particular case doesn't rise to the level of Charles and June Brown being unable to pursue this claim on the basis of that communication not taking place. I would correct Your Honor in terms of who actually asked Charles and June Brown to sign the deed of trust. It wasn't Tina and Travis. It was a requirement on the part of the bank.
Right. So it was either they didn't get the property or
the
parents had to
loan.
Put this up.
Yeah.
I understand. So in effect, they're asking them to do it.
Yeah. You know, in effect, they are. I just, as I say, I don't think that defeats the Charles and June Brown's claim in regard to the action. The property ends up, the 32-acre tract ends up being sold.
What's your best argument that the bank had a duty to pay the delinquent taxes on the vacant lot or to notify Charles and June that they were not being paid? Because it certainly is not in the trust deed document itself.
It's not in that document at all, and in fact, I was going to get to this pretty soon anyway, which I'll do so right now. We have 4 pages in our brief which address that specifically by way of argument, citation, and legal source. Pages 25 through 28. Insofar as the response to that in the appellee's brief, I've been doing this a long time, and I have to admit this is the first time I've ever seen this. They respond to that by way of saying the appellants point to no term of any instrument, no statute, or no common law in support of their position that the bank had a duty to protect that security. That security, meaning the 32-acre tract. And we've got 4 pages in there. Citations in that regard.
But there's no Nebraska case or there's no authority from any state around Nebraska that says that that's the practice.
There's 7 CJS citations, and admittedly, CJS citations are not at the top of the hierarchy in terms of persuadability. There are 4 Nebraska cases that were cited that at least make reference to this and give some inference that there is a duty on the part of a lending party to protect the person and the entities that have given security themselves to make sure that first security, the primary security, is available for somebody. And if they don't do that, they're liable to the what would be Charles and June Brown in this case.
Does the record reflect that the bank was notified that the taxes had not been paid?
We don't get that far because the district judge ruled on a motion to dismiss that particular cause of action, which made reference to that. And so there is those documents that are not in the record because we didn't get that far. I couldn't offer them.
Well, you could have offered them without, is there anything in the record that shows the bank was notified that there was going to be a tax sale because of the delinquent tax?
Not in the record because we didn't get that far. The district judge, in my contention, erroneously dismissed the particular claim that we had that Adams Bank had a duty to protect this security and that they breached that duty by either not paying the taxes or not informing Charles and June about the unpaid taxes so they could come in and do something if they wanted to. Charles and June didn't find out about any of this until they get a letter from the bank in September of 2014 telling them that the note of their son and daughter-in-law is in default and that they now owe $54,000 on that. The tax sale that I was referring to earlier had been concluded a year earlier. It was too late for anybody to do anything at that point. And so Charles and June are just out on a limb there in that regard.
And under the terms of the trust deed that they signed, the promissory note on the vacant lot has to be paid first from the proceeds of the sale of their home property before you can get to the home property being paid off. Do you agree with that?
It does say that.
And so that's how you end up with the deficiency because there's a promissory note that they've signed saying that Bill paid for the their own home, and there isn't sufficient funds from the sale of the house to cover both properties, although if the lien hadn't been lost, there was sufficient security to pay for both, correct?
No, we've got $25,000 approximately of attorney's fees that got added on to this promissory note for which there is an issue in regard to those also. We're claiming that they didn't prove the attorney's fees. We're claiming that they didn't show that the attorney's fees that they have on their bill are related to any instrument term which in fact imposes that liability on Charles and June Brown. Even though the instruments say repeatedly attorney's fees are payable here, there, and everywhere, there's insufficient evidence to show that the attorney's fees that show up on these two exhibits, which constitute these payoff amounts, are anything other than just line entries. We don't see any of the statements in evidence. We've got Mr. Adams that testifies. All he knows about what they're related to are bankruptcies, that's in the plural, together with some injunction action that might have taken place by these clients in an earlier action. That's all we know about the attorney's fees. Had it not been for those, there would have been sufficient property to, there would have been sufficient proceeds left on the sale of the Brown property to, in fact, pay them back about $7,000 that hadn't have been for the attorney's fees. But I don't think we even get to that because the judge erroneously dismissed this first cause of action that requires the secured creditor to fulfill their duty of protecting that first collateral.
Thank you very much. How much time are we taking over? Could you please add that to the appellee's time? Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Members of the court, opposing counsel, today's audience, good afternoon. My name is Mike Samuelson. I'm here on behalf of Adams Family. A couple of matters to bring before the court's attention here this afternoon. I want to address, first of all, there were some recitations in the brief with respect to the court erroneously dismissing a number of the causes of action that were pled by the appellants, particularly on the motion to dismiss that was filed by the bank. The court sustained the motion to dismiss with respect to the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 11th causes of action. There was an argument made in appellant's brief that that was somehow erroneous. I'd like to initially, I guess, address that before we talk about the underlying causes of action that survived that. If your honors look at the order that actually ruled upon the motion to dismiss that was filed by the bank, what the court did was the court makes a recitation in one of the opening paragraphs that the bank owes no duty with respect to the obligations, assertions that the appellants are complaining of. What the court then does is says, accordingly, the first, third, and thereafter causes of action were dismissed. What the appellants argued was that somehow constituted a basically striking of their affirmative defenses. And your honors, when you look at the pleadings in this matter, you'll see that there was an answer and a counterclaim. The answer, starting on approximately paragraph 17 through 41, set forth these various affirmative defenses, which were the same matters that were then erroneously pled as causes of action. So when the court actually, when it dismissed the causes of action, what it basically was saying is causes of action are dismissed, but no mention is made with respect to the paragraph, those affirmative defenses that were earlier set forth in the answer. So as a bit of a housekeeping matter with respect to the issues that were then ultimately decided by the court, that left Adams Bank's claim for a monetary judgment and the appellant's claims that remained, the second of which was fraud, and the 10th cause of action was the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. With respect to the fraud claim, and as set forth in the appellee's brief, the position of Adams Bank is that cause of action fails for a number of reasons, first of which, you have the credit agreement statute of frauds. It's our belief, based upon what the appellants were alleging, was this modification that the bank had somehow agreed to, or that was what was asserted anyway, that based upon those assertions, that type of an agreement would obviously naturally fall within the credit agreement and statute of frauds. The problem from the appellant's perspective, and one that was fatal to their argument, is their witnesses at trial acknowledged that any of these representations were entirely oral. There was nothing that was ever written, and in light of that, the credit agreement statute of frauds dictates judgment for Adams Bank on the second cause of action. Even if the court were to look past the credit agreement statute of frauds, one of the other sort of a well-known concept is Nebraska law is that fraud cannot be premised on unfulfilled promises in the future, which is exactly what you have here. The appellants were alleging that Adams Bank had agreed that if Travis and Tina were current on their note for approximately 1 year after the obligation was incurred, then their contention was Adams Bank had agreed to release the deed of trust. Well, those alleged promises by their very nature are forward-looking and certainly can't stand as a basis for a cause of action for fraud. Third, as this court will note when it reviews the record, the appellant, Charles Brown, never testified. The appellant, June Brown, testified that she could not recall any of the events leading up to the day that particular deed of trust was executed, nor could she recall on the day that it was executed any representations made by the bank. Their daughter-in-law, Tina,
But none of that really matters, does it? I mean, the trustee speaks for itself.
It does.
Let's talk about some of the things that matter in this case.
Sure.
Charles and June Brown did not sign the promissory note on the bank of law. Isn't that true?
They didn't sign the particular promissory note.
That's what I asked you. Yes. The promissory note. And is my understanding the bank would not loan the money on that bank of law unless they signed the trustee for their own property?
There were two promissory notes, Your Honor. The appellants had one for approximately $61,000. Travis and Tina saw a promissory note in the approximate amount of $58,000. And that is correct. The bank would not loan Travis and Tina the obligation in the absence of them signing a deed of trust on their property. That's correct.
So now you have a lien both on the vacant lot, approximately $58,000 note, and you have a lien on the home property of Charles and June, approximately $61,000.
Correct.
And at that point, there's more than enough security for the two loans.
The problem...
Yes, sir?
Yes. That's
now, let's keep going. Now, okay, so at that point, whose responsibility is it to take care of the taxes?
As far as the obligation for the taxes, initially it falls to the individuals who own the property. In this case, that would have been Travis and Tina. The trust document provides, and I think appellants acknowledged in their reply brief, that in the absence of Travis and Tina paying the taxes, the obligation then falls to the trustor, or in this case, the parents, the appellants, Charles and June, with respect to paying the taxes.
It also says the bank may pay the taxes.
That's correct.
All right, let's talk about that aspect, though. The bank chose not to pay the taxes.
The bank was... That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, now, so then we go up to the step where the treasurer is issuing tax certificates for not having paid the taxes, and they get bought up. And we go by a period of time, and then finally we have a tax sale. And the bank still elects not to do anything about the taxes, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so by their decision to do that, they lose their lien on that security on that vacant lot.
Well,
isn't that right?
They did lose it, Your Honor, but if I may,
sure.
As far as the sort of some background information as far as how that situation came about.
Only if it's in the record.
Representations were made that the obligation would be provided and it subsequently was not, and therefore the payments weren't made. When the bankruptcy got dismissed, there was an intervening time when the Chapter 13 bankruptcy got dismissed. Between there and when it was basically placed back on the court's docket was when the application for the trustee.
But the bank would have had the opportunity to redeem the property, to pay the taxes, to buy the tax set. They would have had that opportunity?
It may have upon the dismissal of the bankruptcy, and that point was the same time that the treasurer's taxes was applied.
And the bank chose not to buy it.
The bank was under the understanding that it was being taken care of by the...
It was being sold by the treasurer, and they got notice of it, didn't they? Is there a record of it that you received notice of?
This was actually this was a non-judicial foreclosure.
Right, I understand that. But notice had to be given not only to the owner but also to the lien holder.
Notice was given during the pendency of, I believe, Your Honor. notice may have been given during the pendency of the bankruptcy, and because it was during the bankruptcy and representations had been made that they were taking care of it through the Chapter 13 bankruptcy, that's the reason the bank didn't pay.
And that's in the record.
I'm not sure. With respect to that, Your Honor, I'm not aware of whether or not that is.
Well, let's for purposes of our discussion, say it's not.
Okay.
So now you've got a situation, you're reading this record, the bank had the opportunity to go in and redeem this property or to pay it to protect their interest, and they chose not to do it.
And in hindsight, Your Honor, I think the bank certainly wishes it had.
Okay, so now they're turning around and they take Charles and June's property and they lose their property because of it.
They did foreclose on that deed of trust.
And they got $95,000.
That was correct.
But that left a deficiency.
And
now because the bank screwed up and didn't protect their interest on the other piece of property, they want June and Charles to pay this amount. Is that correct?
Charles and June were obligated under the
deed. I'm just asking you if it's because they let this other property go. Is that the reason why there's a deficiency?
They certainly could have done something else to prevent the situation.
The bank could have.
That's correct.
And so at some point in time, do we need to look at that aspect of it?
With respect to, in that regard, Your Honor, when the contractual obligation is imposed upon appellants, I think the primary, with respect to paying those taxes, that needs to be the first place you look. Certainly, I think Adams Bank in hindsight, the taxes hadn't just been paid, and then we wouldn't be in the situation.
Exactly. But for, what does that do to your case? What does that do for your case? But for the negligence of your bank, these people are going to have to pay another $25,000?
I don't know that it was negligent, or I certainly think they wish they could have done something different under the
Well, they could have done something different. I mean, it was right there.
Yeah. And again, Your Honor, due to representations made, that was ultimately
wide out. Isn't your best argument is that the deed of trust speaks for itself, and the deed of trust said the bank may pay the taxes. It doesn't say shall. It doesn't say will. It says may.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That
was the agreement you had with the borrowers.
That's correct.
Was there ever anything entered into in writing that changed that?
No, Your Honor. And with that, Your Honor, I seem about out of time. We would respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment from the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The appellant is out of time. Thank you very much for being here this afternoon. We appreciate both of you appearing to argue this important case. You are excused. The matter is deemed submitted. That completes this session of the Court of Appeals.